weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
Well, big love to Beto da Silva for driving us through the afternoon with some great music and entertainment. It is Tuesday, July 9th. I'm Shane Dawson and you are listening to Game On. Coming up between now and 7pm, Euro 2024 semi-finals kick off tonight. Paul Corrie and Mark Langdon are with us to preview the heavyweight clash of Spain and France. And we'll also look forward to Shamrock Rovers' Champions League qualifier in Iceland. Shane Stokes has the latest from the Tour de France, and one of the greatest tennis stars Ireland has ever produced, Conor Nyland, is with us to chat about his book, The Racket. One of the most raw, honest and inspiring memoirs from an Irish athlete. As always, if you want to have your say, you can send us a text on 51552 or contact us on WhatsApp 087 187 9200.
Game On on 2FM.
Good evening. Welcome along to the show. A couple of news headlines before we get into this evening's show in full. Starting with rugby, South Africa have named an unchanged match day 23 for Saturday's second test against Ireland in Durban. The world champions lead the two-match series 1-0 following last weekend's 27-20 victory in Pretoria. Razi Erasmus is starting 15, captained by flanker Sia Khaleesi, is the most experienced in Springboks history with 990 caps combined, three more than the total won by the team which began last year's Rugby World Cup final win over New Zealand. Razi Erasmus was speaking to the media today. Obviously no Dan Sheehan, no Craig Casey for Ireland next week, and Razi was questioned on the inclusion or possible inclusion of Conor Murray.
Calmness to the Irish team and Crowley at 10. It's always tough when you have two young nines and tens that, away from home in Test Match rugby, you know. Always how they settle in, but we know Crowley's class, and so was the previous nine who got injured. But Conor has been there, he's done it all, Lions, Munster, European Cups, Pro 14s, all of those kind of things. So he will bring a lot of calmness there. I know him personally well. He's a great team man. So I think overall calmness and obviously a great kicking game with those box kicks might be a little bit longer. Maybe not at sea level that high, but he certainly kicks it the highest I've.
Well, sticking with rugby, Ireland have advanced directly to the semi-finals of the World Rugby Under 20 Championships in South Africa after their pool match against Australia was cancelled due to adverse weather conditions. Having beaten Italy and Georgia in their opening pool games, the Irish side had been due to take on the Junior Wallabies in their final Pool B match. However, the impact of torrential rain on the pitch meant the game did not go ahead, and World Rugby confirmed that would count as a draw. Both teams receiving 2 points. That outcome ensures that Ireland finished top of the pool on 11 points and receive a direct passage to the semi-final. So good news for the young Irish team. In the Tour de France, Ireland's Sam Bennett finished sixth on the 10th stage as Belgium's Jasper Philipsen finally claimed victory in this year's edition by winning a textbook sprint. A few moments ago, just before we came on air, Ireland's Ben Healy, who rode home in 44th on today's stage, is 19th overall in the general classification. He'll be targeting tomorrow's stage with plenty of lofty climbs in that one. Shane Stokes of the Velo website will have all of the details on that a little bit later on. Before that, we will be chatting tennis with Conor Nyland and his book, The Racket, that I mentioned. And Paul Corrie, Mark Langdon will be chatting football. Conor and Paul, as I say, are already in studio. Conor Nyland, how are you, sir?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for popping in. I'm very much looking forward to getting stuck into a good conversation on the book, because it is a fantastic read. Not just saying it because you're sitting across from me, but proper page turner. I read it over the weekend. It was a really fascinating insight, because it's not only, and we will be talking in detail, it's not only about winning at tournaments or just tournaments, it's about the struggles, the disparity of income in tennis and everything that young tennis players have to go through in order to ultimately try and achieve that goal of playing at the top level.
Yeah, that's it. It was a great process for me, and as I say, we'll get into it later. But yeah, that carrot of Wimbledon, which is on right now, was always there for me, and glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah, no, and many others I'm sure have enjoyed it and will enjoy it as well. Out at the moment, speaking of Wimbledon, Sinner loses to Medvedev. Bit of a shock.
Yeah, I think Medvedev has snuck up on us a little bit. Everyone was talking about a Sinner-Alcaraz semi-final, and that was going to be the tough draw. And then Medvedev, he can be an awkward customer. And I think Sinner struggled a little bit. He had the doctor out at one point.
Okay.
He had the head in the towel. I don't know exactly what the issue was. I heard somebody say it was a heart rate being tested at one point, which doesn't sound too good, but he did last the five sets. And Alcaraz looks like he's getting on top of Paul there at Tommy Paul at the moment. So Djokovic came through an interesting one last night after an interesting post-match interview. So,
what did you make of the comments? I was going to question you on this later, but sure, we may as well dive into it now.
Yeah, I was thinking he wouldn't enjoy a Bruce Springsteen concert too much, probably, if that got under his skin. Like, what's he doing, basically, you know, bringing that up, the stature of the guy in terms of what he's won, and then he's having a go with sort of 20 Danish people who were shouting Rune in a way he didn't like. I mean, I kind of know what he means, that they were slightly, were trying to probably get under his skin a small bit in terms of that chant or that shout, whatever you want to call it. But, like, he shouldn't really be getting involved in that sort of stuff, should he?
Yeah. No, he enjoys it, I think.
Oh, he loves it. He loved it. Yeah.
Paul, you're a tennis fan, I'm right in saying?
I love my tennis. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. Have you been keeping an eye on Wimbledon?
Plenty of afternoons when I was away in Sheffield watching the ATP and WTA tour.
Oh yeah.
Plenty of spare time.
You're a tennis hipster. You know, he knows all the small events. Even I'd say.
No, I went to the World Tour Finals at the end of the season.
Oh yeah, London,
in the O2, and I saw Wawrinka play Federer, and it was amazing.
It's a great event, in terms of it's indoors. It was there for a few years in a row, which meant they did a great job in terms of the spectacle. It was great to have it.
They do somewhat drum up the atmosphere a bit more during those events, don't they?
Oh yeah, like there's it's so well sort of lit. It's a great, as I say, it's a great spectacle in terms of how they do it, and you know, it's an event that. You know, it looks like a concert as much as a tennis event.
Okay.
They've moved it around now. It's in Turin, but they had a good run in London and they did a great job. As a spectacle, it was really, really cool.
Okay. Did you play at all, Paul?
No.
Just football for yourself.
I didn't. Yeah. Never got the green light to get into Castleknock Tennis Club.
It's always interesting. I find the sports that you enjoy watching are often sports things that you played yourself growing up. So it's interesting to see that you you enjoyed watching and haven't not played.
There's probably not too many sports I don't watch, and I get that a lot at home. But tennis is one definitely at this time of year. I think when Wimbledon comes around, I think when Queens initially, and then into Wimbledon, you really get a flavour for, and then into the US Open next.
Yeah, there's a few weeks, and then you get into there's the hard court swing and into the US Open end of August. So yeah, it's a nice time of year. And then when you're a kid, it's the school holidays this time of year, so you're able to watch it and get into it. So
That always seemed to be right. When I was growing up as well, at this time of year, you'd have everyone out in the street with a tennis racket. Then when the Six Nations were on, you had everyone kicking a rugby ball. Then when the World Cup were on, or the League of Ireland season, everyone kicking a football. But whenever. You're a football fan as well, a bit of a crossover as well. You've been keeping an eye on the Euros, Connor?
Yeah, a bit. Yeah, I used to play loads of soccer growing up, and I was over in Wimbledon actually on Saturday, and you know, there was people, like, they don't show the football, because obviously the World Cup or Euros is on during Wimbledon every 2 years, so they have this policy where you can't find a TV anywhere in Wimbledon showing it. So there's people like looking at their phones. There's lots of little huddles of people watching phones, looking at the penalty shootout on Saturday, and lots of roaring and stuff. But so I didn't get to see a lot of it on Saturday, but yeah, it should be an interesting next couple of nights.
My partner's surname is Hemming.
I think you've mentioned this.
So I am waiting for the the invite
for the ticket,
over.
Didn't
happen in 2024, maybe 2025.
Well, Tim, if you're listening, 51552 is the text number.
Victoria, if you're listening. Never mind Tim. Sort it out.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. The call to arms has begun. Mark Langdon also joins us as we dive into our football chat. But first, Mark, are you a tennis fan? Have you been keeping an eye on Wimbledon?
I mean, I keep an eye on Wimbledon in the sort of odd number years. But once... when it's World Cup and Euros, I find that sort of all-consuming. Not as much as I probably should do. That there are sort of... I mean, there was that sort of time, wasn't there, when Nadal, Federer and Djokovic were all kind of at the peak of their powers and it felt like you just had to watch it. I'm not sure if there's kind of... I know Alcaraz is somebody that people feel can get to that level. Maybe just haven't got that kind of, and maybe we'll never get to that era again, but it felt unmissable then. Not the moment though.
Okay. No, that's fair. There's a lot of sport on at the moment. Speaking of big names and big stars, no Pedri for Spain. Obviously, he's out for the rest of the tournament. Kylian Mbappe is there with his mask for France. Paul, are we going to see an entertaining, exciting game of football this evening, or is it going to be a drab affair where the players look a bit tired and someone might just crawl over the line?
Well, firstly, I think Spain have been superb to date in this tournament. They're probably one of the few teams that have really showed up and hit the levels that you were expecting of themselves. And I think when you look at the likes of France, Portugal, England, so many of them fell short. So I would expect that the game, Shane, is probably not going to throw out too many surprises. The Spanish will likely dominate possession of the ball. They will look to impose their game on France and try use the energy and pace that they have out wide in Williams and Lamel. So I would expect that would be the way the game will play out. The French will sit deep. They'll be more than happy, I think, to soak up as much pressure as they possibly can and then look to counter on using kind of the legs that they have at the top end of the pitch with the likes of Mbappe. I expect Mbappe will probably start tonight. I thought he was really good when he came on in the last game. And I think that sort of threat can get at Spain. I kind of look back at the last 16 game when they played against Georgia, and Georgia were really effective on the counter-attack but probably just didn't have that bit of quality to really be efficient in front of goal and take advantage of the opportunities that they created. I know France haven't been brilliant to date when it comes to creating chances and scoring goals, but if they can connect and if they can put things together, they certainly have that threat at the top end of the pitch that I think can really, really hurt Spain, because Spain, you know, they attack with 10-11 bodies. They really commit to that, but that also means that you leave a lot of space at the back, and I just fear for Spain in that sense. And I think France, with just the experience of being at this stage of competition and the firepower that they have at the top end of the pitch, I think that could be enough to get them over the line tonight.
Okay, from France's point of view, Mark, I know Didier Deschamps doesn't seem to be too bothered by the boring tag that is being labelled on them. Three goals, though, have been two own goals and a penalty scored by Mbappe. Have they rode their luck a bit, I suppose?
I don't know if they've rode their luck. They haven't been in sort of that much bother, really. The game against Portugal was tight. You know, it goes to penalties and could go either way. I thought against Belgium, I know it was sort of an own goal and the goal came late, but I mean, I don't remember Belgium having sort of one chance in that game. In the group stage, they'd already kind of got the job done before they drew with Poland. And I mean, Didier Deschamps doesn't care. I mean, if he wanted to be more expressive, he could drop Griezmann back in alongside two other midfielders. He could play Mbappe on one side, Dembele on the other, and, you know, Thuram or Kolo Muani up front and sort of really go for it. I don't think he'll sort of feel the need that, you know, France need to play in that way. So I would hope to see Dembele and Mbappe on the wings, and, you know, Griezmann may have to play through the middle. But for all that France have been boring, I mean, defensively, they've been outstanding, and that is one part of the job. I mean, it's the ugly part of the job, but they haven't given up that many chances. The only goal they've conceded so far was that Lewandowski penalty that was missed the first time around, because Maignan saved it and then it had to be retaken. But I mean, Saliba's been brilliant for France. I mean, they don't attack with too many players, but Deschamps has never worried about that. He didn't worry about that as a player. He's not going to worry about it as a manager. And I agree with Paul. I can see a situation here where Spain sort of go out with all the plaudits and that France kind of finish them off, even if it does go extra time or penalties. A bit like how in the last Euro, I thought that Spain were playing the best football, and then Italy beat them at this stage, didn't they, on penalties. So, I sort of would edge toward France as well.
How much is cohesion in the Spanish group, Paul, beneficial to them? Because I think I was reading that the base of the squad comes from under-19s, under-21 victories in previous European championships. Yvalmo, Fabian Ruiz, Marino, Unai Simon were all part of those successes, and that's similar to the golden generation of Spain not too long ago. Cucurella and Pedri, I know Pedri is injured now, silver medalist at the Tokyo Olympics as well. So to have that core group, and then you add the likes of Dani Carvajal, Morata's now captain, Rodri, so it seems to be the perfect blend, and everyone's genuinely singing off the same hymn sheet.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way, Shane, and I think what you've spoken about there is very true, in the sense that they seem to have a lovely balance through the side. You look down through the spine of the team: Morata, Rodri, Ruiz, Laporte, Simon. Like, there's a lot of experience in those players, and they've played at the top end of European football for a long period of time. That almost gives you a foundation to begin putting the team together, and then you sprinkle in that youth and Yamal and Williams. And with young players, when they get to a situation or a stage like this, they sometimes play with a little more freedom than somebody who's been around the block for such a long period of time. And you can see that in the performances. Yamal is making it look so easy at times at 16 years of age, and Williams on the other side as well has been such a threat going forward. So there does seem to be that lovely balance through the squad, and they're going to be tested tonight, because you take Danny Carvajal out of the team, Jesus Navas will come in at 38 years of age, Loman comes out, Nacho comes in, and Pedri will also come out, and Dani Amo will come in. So that squad and the depth of the squad is certainly going to be tested tonight. But I think throughout the group stages, the game against Georgia and the game against Germany, they've been the one team who have been really impressive about how they've gone about their business. They've been very front foot, both in possession and out of possession, and they've really lit up the tournament. And a large part of me would actually like to see them rewarded for that, to get to the final and to impose themselves again. I think whoever comes out of this tie will eventually go on and win the tournament. And if it is to be Spain, I don't think anybody could argue that they don't deserve it.
I think Guillaume Balaguer had a profile piece on the Spanish manager Mark Luis de la Fuente, and he mentioned that he's a man just totally devoid of ego, someone who believes that it is the team rather than the individuals that matter most, and kind of following on from what Paul was describing there, Mark, that's exactly what Spain need.
Yeah, I think it's what sort of all international managers need, really, because it's about harmony and balance and kind of getting partnerships going all over the pitch. And that might not necessarily mean picking the best players and trying to fit them into a team. And I you know, there was criticism of the squad that he selected, you know, in various parts. Lucas Vazquez went on Twitter and did a laughing emoji when he was left out. I remember there was a lot of Premier League observers that felt that Pedro Porro should have been in as the kind of backup right back instead of Jesus Navas. But I think De La Fuente probably knew that Navas kind of understood his position within that team, and he'd be the understudy. And when players have come out, like Dani Olmo, for instance, I think would feel like he should be starting every game, but there was no hint of him sort of sulking when he then comes on for Pedri. He makes a difference. Morata sacrifices himself and you know, for the team in most games for Atletico Madrid and also for the Spanish national team. The two wide players have been phenomenal in their work. So yeah, I mean, he has managed to keep a really happy camp. And even at left back, like Cucurella, most European observers would have said that Grimaldo, following the season he had with Leverkusen, would start. But clearly, you know, the manager sort of understood what was needed from the team, and Cucurella's, I think, played really well. I wouldn't be his biggest fan at Chelsea, and thought that they overspent by a considerable distance, but he finished last season well for Chelsea. He's carried that form right on into the Euros as well. I mean, he's somebody, De La Fuente, that I mean, how many people kind of knew him really sort of before he got the Spanish national team job? He was very much somebody that worked in the background, you know, with the youth teams, as you already mentioned. You know, this is not somebody that's a Nagelsmann or a Deschamps that's kind of got a managerial sort of CV or a big playing one either. So he understands the role, and he's got the best out of the team. And I do think that balance, as Paul mentioned it earlier, but so important in international football. The amount of times managers try to just chuck on like the best players and get them to work into a formation and shape, and it just doesn't work. They don't do that at club level, and yet international level, so many of them try to do that, and Spain definitely haven't.
Paul, I asked this question not tongue-in-cheek, genuinely. Is Kylian Mbappe's mask holding him back? Because already he tried on 8 of them, apparently, and it's uncomfortable, it's distracting, it doesn't give him the right peripheral vision, I believe, as well.
Maybe not the mask, but the broken nose certainly is.
Yeah, like, that is a massive factor to contend with.
If you're going out with a broken nose and playing a competitive game, it has to be on your mind at some point. And poor Ellen Mbappe, did you see against Portugal, the ball got floated to the back post, he's marking Bernardo Silva.
Even when I saw it, like, in the air, I'm like, oh no, oh no.
Call him plush in the face. The poor fella, he must have been thinking, can just hit anywhere else in my body. But I think it has. He didn't come into the tournament, Shane, in the best of form. He was out and missed a couple of games with Paris Saint-Germain through injury, and then the broken nose probably compounds things where he can't really get himself into the tournament. And then you think back to some of the missed chances he had, particularly the one against Austria, the opening game. You probably feel maybe if he gets off to a good start and gets himself off the mark, he builds from there and gathers a bit of momentum. But it seems to be really stop-start. And the way the France have set up probably hasn't helped either. I think a lot of their build-up play has been quite pedestrian, whereas Mbappe probably wants to utilise the space in behind, and that probably lends itself to getting the ball forward a little more quickly or a little more directly and playing in behind opposition. He hasn't been brilliant, but that's not to say that he won't light it up tonight. It doesn't take much for him, and I think this space that Spain will allow him could potentially bring him into the game and could potentially create a couple of problems. I just look at those fullback areas. We spoke about Cucurella. Cucurella's been brilliant in this tournament, but as a Chelsea fan, when I've seen him in 1v1 situations, he has looked very, very reliable at times. And Jesus Navas as well, coming in at 38 years of age, that is a huge test if you're going up against Mbappe. So it hasn't really happened for him. I do believe that mask and the broken nose, people probably aren't allowing or forgiving some of his performances enough based on what has happened, but I think tonight could be a real opportunity for him to take advantage.
Okay, should be a cracker. That one kicks off at 8 o'clock live on RTE2 on the RTE Player, and there's live updates on the RTE Sport website as well. We will be previewing Netherlands and England in detail on tomorrow's show. The Champions League is back though this evening, just 38 days after Real Madrid won the Champions League final. The 2024-25 tournament kicked off this afternoon at 4:30 Irish time in Lithuania, in the city of Panevėžys, the fifth largest city in Lithuania. The Champions League is back. Shamrock Rovers are in Iceland to take on Víkingur Reykjavík. 7:45 kickoff for that one Irish time. There's live updates on the RTÉ Sport website, and that one is live on LOI TV. And we can hear from the Shamrock Rovers manager Stephen Bradley ahead of this evening's clash.
These are a good team. There's no doubt that you can see they're coached well and are very, very dangerous in the attacking towards them. It's a tough tie. There's no doubt about that. We know we've got to be at a very top level in Europe, and at this level, where if you're not at your top level, you very quickly get punished and get found out. So we know where they're strong. We know where we can hurt them, but we got to make sure we're focused.
Now, we will be leaning on Mark Langdon, who usually comes up with some golden nuggets in these qualifying ties. But, Paul, if I come to you first on Shamrock Rovers.
I thought you were going to ask him about Víkingur Reykjavík.
Well, I will. I will in due course. Don't you worry. They're banging form. They're banging form. So no pressure on you, Mark, now. But from a Shamrock Rovers point of view, Paul, listen, it's well documented their struggles in the league at present as well. Will a run in Europe come as a welcome distraction or a bit of a headache?
It might come as a welcome distraction, particularly off the win that they had last week against Dundalk, but I can't recollect Shamrock Rovers in recent years, Shane, coming into Europe in such poor form. Lost 4 of their last 6 before they played Dundalk last week, and not only the results but some of the performances have been very inconsistent, and we've probably seen a real drop in performance from some of the key players that they've had in the last couple of years. Now, what has helped during the break is that they've been able to get bodies back into the team, the likes of Gary O'Neill, Dylan Watts. Jack Byrne looked a little more fresh last week when he came out in the pitch, and you would hope that the combination of getting players back and maybe some of the confidence that they would have garnered from the Dundalk victory might be somewhat of a recipe to get a bit of a better performance out of them. But I think tonight, Shane, is all about keeping the game nice and tight. I don't think Stephen Bradley will want this open and end to end and a bucket load of chances for both sides. I think he'll be looking to keep this as tight as he possibly can, aim for a clean sheet. And how you get that is by just organising the bodies, particularly from your back three all the way to Gary O'Neill in centre midfield. Try make it as frustrating as possibly for Víkingur, and make sure that Leon Poles is not busy in goals. I think if you can keep this at 0-0 and get back to Tallinn next week, you give yourself a really good hope and a really good shot of getting through. But on the basis of what we've seen to date from Shamrock Rovers in the league, I actually think it's going to be a really, really stiff test.
Okay. Listen, Mark, I'm not going to question you too detailed on the Icelandic league, but like last year, Shamrock Rovers, they lost 1-0 at home to Icelandic opposition before a 3-1 aggregate loss was confirmed in Iceland as well. Their opponents, they are top of the league at the moment, having won 2 of the last 3 editions of the top flight, ending a 30-year wait. So they are in form, and not that Shamrock Rovers would, or Stephen Bradley would as well, but there has to be an emphasis that complacency cannot slip in, considering Rovers' domestic form as well going up, because what is going to be, as Paul mentioned, a genuinely extremely stiff task.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the one thing I always look at at this stage of the competition particularly is the sort of UEFA coefficient for the leagues, because you can always pick holes in sort of, you know, one team that kind of, you know, that kind of flukes it and it's not quite right. But you know, Ireland 35, Iceland 41. So there's not that much really between the two nations, really. If you average that out over sort of coefficient points, it doesn't come out to much at all. And I think it is really a case of making sure you're still in the tie after that first leg. I mean, you know, the UEFA coefficients would say that the Irish league is slightly stronger, but there isn't much in it, is there, really?
No. Gents, before I do conclude our football chat, considering you won't be on the show tomorrow, Holland against England, or the Netherlands, I should say, against England. Mark, how do you see this one playing out?
Oh, I think it's a really tight game. I probably edge slightly towards Netherlands, just on the basis that, you know, they're scoring a lot of goals. The only time they didn't score at least twice was against France, when they came away with the sort of goalless draw. England, I thought, was slightly better against Switzerland, but it was a low bar, really, from what we've seen. And, you know, during this tournament, they've played five games. They've only won one of them in sort of 90 minutes, and that was not that convincing against a Serbian team that didn't play well. And so I think if you look at Netherlands, they played against Austria, they've played against France, probably more sort of stronger form, I would say. So be a tight game, but I'd probably edge just towards the Dutch side.
Paul, would you be siding with the Dutch as well?
I think it'll be really edgy. I really do. I think it'll be a very tight game. I don't think either side will maybe want to kind of commit too much. I think it'll be very sort of balanced in play. And I'd be inclined to agree with Mark. I just think the Dutch, on the basis of what I've seen in the last couple of games, they seem to be finding something in that final third. Gakpo looks really well out in that left side. Depay has a goal in him, whether it be Bergwijn or another in that final third. They seem to carry a bit more of a threat than the English side. And just for that reason, Shane, I would just slightly edge in the way of the Netherlands. But I think that will be a really tight game.
OK, great stuff. Paul Corrie, Mark Langdon, thank you both very much for chatting football this evening. Craig Bellamy's new Wales manager. Bellamy will succeed Rob Page, who was sacked last month after turning down the opportunity to stay at Burnley under new Clarets boss Scott Parker. Is our final bit of football news, but we're going to have to leave the conversation there for now. And we're taking a short ad break, and then Conor Nyland is with us to chat Wimbledon, and most importantly, to chat about his fascinating book, The Racket.
Game on.
Tennis.
Now, Conor Nyland, one of the greatest tennis stars that Ireland has ever produced, joins us now to chat about his new book, The Racket, which I have to say is one of the most revealing, deeply insightful and honest books I've read about an athlete in recent times. Conor, as I mentioned at the top of the show, it is great to have you in studio. Thanks so much for joining us. Why did you bring out the book? What stories did you feel needed to be told?
Yeah, thanks for the kind words on it. Listen, we spent the guts of 4 years working on this book, and it was really important for me to be honest about the tour, and I felt like there'd obviously been plenty written and some good books, like Andre Agassi's book about the very top of the game, but there was this place, I suppose, where, you know, the guys who were trying to get to Wimbledon, that story hadn't been told. So it's the crazy life of the guy between, say, 100 and 300 in the world. And it's not my autobiography. It's, I suppose, I'm the guy who shows you the world and what it looks like. But also you're getting a bit of a sense of what that very top tier is like, as I got the chance to play a couple of Grand Slams. So you're seeing the two sides of the coin in this book.
I love how it's worded in terms of, if you're not a tennis fan, even if you're not a sports fan, you're educated about how tennis works as well, and there's personal stories. But if you are a tennis fan as well, there's like fascinating insight about the details and the small details about the journey.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Like, we definitely pitched it that people who aren't necessarily tennis fans, and even not necessarily sports fans, can enjoy this. So we explain, you know, how the point system works, the scheduling, some of the mistakes that I made in terms of that coming out of college. And yeah, we go into the money. There's the gambling piece. There's the injuries. There's the doping. All that stuff is sort of touched upon. And again, going back to the detail in terms of the writing style here, there's an awful lot of detail into my feelings. I think the book is at its strongest probably when you feel like you're in my head when I'm sitting in the locker room or in the airport, and I'm sort of taking you through you know, my thoughts and feelings in a really detailed and honest way.
Mm. You mentioned about getting inside your head. I do want to rewind a bit about how you started and how your career started. But in terms of getting inside your head, and I think it's fair to say you certainly attest to the fact that tennis players can be still haunted by significant defeats, perhaps significant wins, not haunted, but they stick with them. And many people might be familiar, perhaps some aren't, that a hugely significant match and moment in your career, is fair to say, was the 5-set loss to Manarino at Wimbledon in 2011. And I think in the book you mentioned, the memory just pops into your head, intruding at random times. Now, you were a break of serve and up in the final set. You would have played Roger Federer. Two breaks of serve.
Sorry, that's the real killer. That's,
which makes it even worse. Even exactly. Worse.
Doubly worse. Yeah.
That's why you're here, to get that fine detail for us. You would have played Roger Federer on centre court, so kind of the only show in town, really, centre court at Wimbledon. So
doesn't get any bigger than that. Yeah.
How troubling was that defeat mentally for you, and also how difficult was that to genuinely move on from?
It hurt so much that I buried it so deep that I didn't even probably appreciate it till I had a book in me about that, basically. You know, this was this journey for me for the 25-30 years I was playing tennis for my family. We'd been working towards you know, the holy grail, I suppose, of playing in Wimbledon, and then I was 6 or 7 points away from the Federer centre court match, and fortunately got a little bit tight, a little bit nervous, and didn't get over the line. And writing this book was cathartic in that sense, and dedicated an entire chapter to that match. And it takes you inside back into my head for that whole match. But definitely writing the book has helped me park it a little bit, and I've sort of turned, I suppose, what was a negative thing into a positive thing in terms of being able to write about it. I look back at it now with a wry smile, but again, that's because I have to. I did get the chance to play in a main stadium court a few months later, which did help too. Certainly for the first 2 years, there was sort of a day didn't go by really when it didn't pop into my head. It's a little bit less now, but it'll stay with me forever. And again, listening to John McEnroe, he talks about losing a French Open final against Lendl back in the 80s, and I know he still talks about the fact that still sort of haunts him. So it doesn't change, but it just gets a little bit easier. But writing the book has definitely helped.
That moment playing in Wimbledon, and I think it's one of your family members you see in the crowd and you lock eyes with, was, given the stature of that tournament in particular, in a way, was it almost the pinnacle of your career, but also the lowest ebb as well, if that makes sense, considering how it finished?
Yeah, it was. It was bittersweet. I mean, I would say the best moment of my career was qualifying into Wimbledon, which is off-site in a place, you know, it's basically Roehampton Cricket Ground, and it's, you know, the courts are pretty shoot up, and there's a, talk about it in detail in the book, there's a marquee where you kind of chuck your bags in and you get your lunch by giving a guy a little ticket that you'd get at a raffle, but you're trying to play the biggest tournament in the world. And when I qualified, I fell down on my knees, and it was like I'd won Wimbledon, you know, it was the same kind of celebration. And then, yeah, obviously, when you get to the big event, you're kind of so in your own head and trying to just perform and get a win that you can't really necessarily be looking around and enjoy it. And again, refer to that a couple of times in the book, where my gaze comes up off the ground. You're usually looking about 2 metres ahead of you, looking down, not looking up. Mm. And occasionally I looked up at the crowd and, you know, see my mum looking at me, smiling, and you get those little moments. But you can't really go to that place either, because you're trying to perform. But yeah, at the same time, still a really special experience, and having it so close to Ireland, lots of fans, the atmosphere was unbelievable, and built throughout, because it was 4 hours long. We got the opportunity to build the atmosphere, and I was over at Wimbledon on the weekend and popped in, had a little look at court 17 like I always do. There's usually a doubles match or something going on when I go down there. It's not usually one of the bigger courts.
Was that tough for you?
I've been doing it for the last 10 years now. So
it gets a bit easier every time.
I keep doing it. I keep going back. Am I getting any better? It's a good barometer. But no, it does. Look, I walk around with a smile on my face and say I played here, you know. So that's definitely my takeaway.
Given all the struggles and the disparity of income and the unrivaled dedication that you need to become a tennis player, when you're going through that journey and when you reflect on it now, is it lonely? Was it rewarding?
Yeah, I mean, it's that balance. And a lot of people have asked me, you know, having read the book, you know, would you do it again? Because it does seem to be so so tough and ask so much of you. And yeah, really lonely at times. And especially, I think, for an Irish player, because, you know, lots of these guys from France, Germany, Spain will have 7-8 guys at every tournament from their home country and associated then coaches. So there's actually a group of 10 plus people who were your compatriots at every event, whereas I was often going up on my own, and guys like James McGee, who were a few years behind me, would have been doing the same at a slightly different stage in his career, so we often weren't travelling together. That made it a lot tougher. But I tell you what, I'm really glad I got to tick the boxes of playing Grand Slam tennis, because if I'd gone through all that and not done it, I could have been talking about somebody, oh, I was 129 in the world, and they'll say, okay, well, what does that mean? You know, it's very hard for people to have a context what that means, but the fact that I did it, persevered, got to play the big events. They could have gone a little bit better for me, obviously, in the first round, Wimbledon, the US Open. But the fact that I got to play those events meant that it was justified. Mm. And it's probably no coincidence that when I got to those events, summer of 2011, I actually retired April 2012. Now, I had hip problems and it was bothering me, but I think it was a case of it allowed me to kind of let go and kind of move on, because I'd done it. And if I'd been really enjoying it and really loving it, I probably would have found a way to keep going, because I was only 30 when I finished.
Do you feel you fulfilled your potential with the resources you had?
I think I maxed out pretty much what was available to me. I think I had a lot more in me in terms of if I had made some decisions. You know, I talk about it in the book, or go to Nick Bollettieri Tennis Academy in Florida at 16, and I mean, my friend Stephen Nugent were there for the first couple of days with the sort of summer campers and on a back court, and then before we knew it, we were hitting with Serena and Venus Williams and Andy Roddick and Peter Korda, who was 2 in the world at the time, and the amount of opportunity just and ease, I suppose, in terms of the, you know, accommodation was there, the courts were there, world class players, the sun was shining, huge opportunities. But at 16, we decided to go back home. I went back to England. He was to a boarding school. He went back to Ireland, and we definitely left a bit on the table with those kinds of decisions. So if I look back now, I think definitely that ages between, say, 13 and 17 are so crucial. They can be such, again, the small margin, my highest ranking, 129. But if I had gotten inside the top 50 for 4 or 5 years, it would have been 4 slams a year, you know, 25 slams potentially I would have played. So such a small difference in ranking and such a big difference in terms of outcomes. So yeah, a couple of decisions there would have really helped.
Why do we not produce top 50 tennis players in this country? Because if I look at somebody like a Serbia, which doesn't have a huge population, that also has a number of other sports going on, and that's producing a Tipsarevic, a Djokovic, a Jankovic, and a Ivanovic.
Yeah, and you're right, and we can't use the excuse of Gaelic football and hurling take our best talents along with rugby and soccer, because they have their basketballs and water polos and handballs and, you know, those sports. So I think it's a combination of things. Obviously, we don't have that run in the summer, as you can see today, where, you know, in Serbia and these places, maybe they do get a bit of a run from May to September where they can play outdoors pretty much every day on clay courts. It's a domestic circuit problem as well in terms of tournaments, that they have major tour events and smaller world ranking events for juniors that we don't have. Obviously, they have role models then, and guys who have made it. Like when I came out of college, I had guys like Scott Barron and Owen Casey who had played Olympics, were sort of 200 in the world, but they were kind of finishing when I started. And it would have been amazing for me to travel with those guys for the first few years, them to show me the ropes. And I feel like we're at such a disconnect in terms of our production line that there's no overlap of players, which does really help too. Like a 16, 17 year old Serbian guy, you can guarantee the number one in Serbia for that age group has spent loads of time with Djokovic in terms of training. He brings them in. So it's about kind of breaking I suppose, breaking through in terms of getting one person to do it, and then hopefully we can create a bit of a bit of a pathway. But like one afternoon in 40 years basically for the Irish at Wimbledon is not really good enough. So
is it all about exporting the talent still to this day, that we need to get bodies to a Madrid, or we need to get bodies to a US?
Yeah, I think, and I don't have a problem with that, because a lot of countries do that. Like, I don't have a problem with us saying to our number one 16-year-old, listen, you need to go to Spain, but we'll somehow provide some help in terms of you getting set up over there. I think it's more advisory stuff, and also bringing our best talents to the biggest events, the biggest team competitions, the biggest individual competitions, because again, that was something that we didn't do a whole lot. Like, I was brought to the big European events maybe once or twice a year max, you know, whereas I should have been getting 10, 15 year, tournaments a year in terms of exposure to the best players. And you know, that's again that's a few misses that we had along the way.
That's similar to other sports. I mean, we don't have a velodrome, we've a track in Crumlin really, and a lot of cyclists I know, perhaps weather dependent as well, train overseas. Rashida obviously on the colour scene in American athletics as well. So can Tennis Ireland learn from that, or might we need to tweak the structures internally? And I thought it would help if we had a big tournament here.
Yeah, I mean, I think a big tournament is something that would, yeah, I think the media could get behind it. You could also obviously get wild cards for your best players, which would give them prize money, very simply, but also experience and opportunity to win big points. So I don't see why, you know, every country in Western Europe pretty much can have at least one tour event on the men's or the women's side, and Ireland can't. I know it's that they can be expensive to get off the ground, but I do think there'll be the sponsorship there. Like, if you had a warm-up tournament for Wimbledon on grass, you know, in June, like Emma Raducanu, Naomi Osaka, you know, you could all of a sudden have somebody who's working their way back, a Caroline Wozniacki. It doesn't even need to be at the very, very top tier for them to come over. So I think there's an opportunity there potentially to do it.
Given all that you've experienced personally, any parents perhaps listening in, or young boys or girls who are thinking about tennis or are still playing tennis at the moment, and they're hemming and hawing about, will I continue with it? Would you recommend it to young people starting off in their journey?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot worse things you could be doing, but I think you just need to be eyes wide open about it, and do it properly. And if you are good at, if you do want to sort of swim with the sharks and try and be a top 50 player in the world, you better realise that at 12 or 13 you need to start, you know, getting your tournament schedule in order. You need to be travelling. And unfortunately, that's not something everybody's prepared to do, especially when you're probably playing a team sport. You know, you're looking for your academics, all that stuff. So it's hard to do, to be all things to all people, unfortunately, with tennis. So you need to get quite serious quite young. But I think there's a way. And again, even if you look at Wimbledon this year, like Emma Navarro, Lulu Sun, two women's quarterfinalists, both went to college in the States. I think they both graduated. So there is potential, if you know, to be able to do both in terms of the athletics and the academics.
One phrase that actually really, really stuck with me, I think it was, you were playing Djokovic in the US Open 2011, perhaps, and I think you wrote in your book, and you do have a degree in English, and I think this shines through in this particular sentence, that on changing of ends, Djokovic was posing straight backed and sphinx like, reminding you of your father, how he sat reading the newspaper at home, which I genuinely did love. Your family and your parents, your father played Gaelic football for Mayo, intercounty footballer as well. How essential is it to have that support network?
Yeah, it was massive, especially when, you know, talking about maybe the lack of supports we had from the federation at the time. It was all on them, you know, when they were such a big part of it. Now, another phrase in the book is that tennis players and their parents come as a package deal. Like, it's you can't really you can't go anywhere, I suppose, without that support, and they were, you know, massively influential. And again, I talk about it in the book, when I retire, you know, my conversations with my dad were a little bit stilted for the first 6 months or a year, because we didn't have my tennis career to sort of talk about, so we had to kind of find our way a little bit. It so much falls on them, and you see it in the players' box at Wimbledon. A lot of them wearing tracksuits and hats, looking like they're, you know, Pep Guardiola or Jose Mourinho. They're the coaches as well as the parents.
There can be positives and negatives to that, though, I'd imagine.
Yeah, I mean, there's
you don't
so
want to be
stories.
Over burdening or overbearing.
Yeah, and it's a really fine line. And, you know, at what point do you need to give your kid a bit of a push to go and do their homework or do their you know, whatever it is, their chores, and at what point do you need to lay off? And it's the same with tennis. Like, you probably need the odd time to get a bit of a push to do your practice, and at other times it needs to come from you. So it's that constant fine line.
Would you encourage your own children? They're 7 and 5, am I right?
They got rained off today from their summer camp.
There'll be a lot of that, I would say. Do you have to almost take a little bit of a hands-off approach because there's so much information going through your head?
I think you can know a bit too much, and I probably err on the side of being a bit too relaxed maybe about it. I think the less you know, I think the more gung-ho you can be about it. And again, my parents, my dad didn't play growing up. As I say, he was Gaelic football. My mum had played a bit but wasn't really knowledgeable about the professional game, so I think that helped in terms of them going into it a little bit eyes wide open. So for me, I'm not sure, but they're playing, you know, they're doing taekwondo and they're doing hockey and all sorts, and let's see, you know. But I think I'd be letting them drive it more than me.
Your current tennis fix, Davis Cup captain, non-playing captain for Ireland. How are you finding that? I think Tunisia in September?
Yeah, Tunisia Portugal? Away. We had a real run of away matches for a few years, and we had Austria at home in Limerick in February, which was brilliant in UL. We had 2,500 people on the Saturday and then the same on the Sunday. Dominic Thiem played for Austria. It was a phenomenal weekend. We're away now in Tunisia, but I really enjoyed it. I always loved Davis Cup. It was team environment. You know, you had your support in terms of two coaches, a physio. I always loved it, and I've been doing it since I was 18, whether a player or a coach, and it's kind of part of my year, that one or 2 weeks a year. So I love it.
Brilliant. Listen, Conor Allen, thank you so much. As I mentioned, genuinely, it is a great read, so I would encourage anyone thinking about it to purchase the racket. It is out now, written by Conor Allen, with help as well from Gavin Cooney, I think it's to be mentioned as well, a fine journalist and a great writer in his own stead as well. For now, Conor, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Enjoy the rest of Wimbledon.
Paul,
enjoy the rest of Wimbledon as well, and then hopefully enjoy Rovers getting a victory this evening if you're that way inclined. We're taking a break, and then we're chatting cycling with Shane Stokes.
RTE 2FM. Game on 2FM.
Now, Shane Stokes of the Velo website joins us now to wrap up the Tour de France. Jasper Philipsen won today's stage with Sam Bennett finishing in sixth place. Shane, a good result or a frustrating result in terms of Sam's finish?
Both, actually. It's encouraging in that it's his highest placing yet. He was ninth in the first sprint and would have been a good bit higher had he not been blocked in then. So in that light, sixth will be seen as a disappointment. Sam in the sprint was on the wheel of Pascal Ackermann, a rider who he's regularly been faster than in recent years, but couldn't hold the wheel of Pascal Ackermann and went on to finish third. So something's not quite right yet with Sam. I think they feel he's moving closer towards where he needs to be, but he's also running out of time to do something in this tour. So there's three, maybe four stages left that'll suit him for the entirety of the rest of the race. So I think the pressure is coming on now to try and deliver on what he was targeting before the start of the race, which was at least one stage win.
Okay, and for the stage winner then, Belgium's Jasper Philipsen. Hasn't really clicked for him until today.
No, he was the dominant sprinter in last year's tour. He won three stages and the green jersey and was expected to dominate again this year. But today was the first day he's won a stage. So he seems to be getting back in the flow of things. But Biniam Girmay, who you might remember early in the tour, became the first Black African to win a stage of the tour in the tour's history, and indeed went on to take a second stage win. He continues to lead the green jersey, the points competition, and has a good lead over Jasper Philipsen in that. And if Girmay was second today, and if he keeps scoring as he does, he could well hold on to that until the race end, which would be further history in the tour, which would be a fantastic result. So, it's going to be interesting to see what happens in the remaining sprint stages. But I think he's certainly a rider that's a better climber than Jasper Philipsen, and the sprint stages ahead, some of them are a bit more testing, so that could favour him.
Okay. Shane, before I let you go, Ben Healy, 44 today, 19th overall in the general classification, but he's targeting tomorrow's stage.
Very much so, yeah. Brendan's riding well. He's 19th overall, as you say. It's his first tour. He would have been higher, except he had to ride for a teammate, Richard Carapaz, in stage four. But Ben told me yesterday that he's not targeting the general classification. He's very much going for a stage win. And he said yesterday that the stage 11, tomorrow's stage to Lilleurl, is the one that he's very much going for. It's a very hilly stage. It's not massive mountains like you'll see in the Alps or Pyrenees, but it's just regularly up and down. And that's a stage that will favour Ben very, very well. So his goal is to get in the early breakaway and basically to outlast everybody else in the breakaway, which he's very good at, kind of repeated efforts and a long day in the saddle. So, yeah, look for him to get into the break tomorrow. And if he does manage to get into the break, then he could well go on to win the stage.
Well, here's hoping it does go well for Ben Healy. For now, Shane Stokes of the Velo website, thank you so much for taking the call. Shane, big thanks to John Farrell, today's producer. Big thanks to Sean Marham for working on the show as well. Big thanks to you for listening. Rachel May Hannon is up next with the new music show. We're taking a short break now, and then we'll check in with the news desk. Game On is back from 6 o'clock tomorrow, and I'll chat to you then.
RTE 2FM.